huge news, years in the making, my brand new book that my publishers refuse to publish, Money Matrix. Beat the money system and build generational wealth. Understand the three main ways that the banks productize you and make money from you. You'll be able to turn that system against itself, build generational wealth and multiple streams of recurring income. It's all at moneymatrix.cash. And if you're quick, the first few hundred registrants and buyers will receive many special bonuses from me. The brand new Moneymaker Summit 3-day special event. Meet me at a champagne reception. Meet me at a multi-millionaire networking dinner. Go now, moneymatrix.cash. This is huge.
Welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast.
What does the word disruptive mean to you?
Means going beyond the ordinary, going beyond the status quo.
Not thinking in the conventional way, not just sort of following the herd.
Disruptive means shaking things up, you know?
Disruptive entrepreneur is somebody who sees the problem and embraces the problem with a new way.
Shake up and awakening.
Quality will take care of itself, and you'll go from being disruptive, but also profitable.
When you use your own reservoir of talent, when you love what you do, then you disrupt.
Mix it up, change it up, and dominate.
And now, your host, 8 times best-selling author and double world record holder, Rob Moore.
Hi, it's Rob Moore here, and welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast. Now, one of the best books I read in 2005-6, which was my breakthrough year in personal development, was a book called How to Be a Billionaire by Martin Fridson. Back then, the cover was gold. It was a big, thick book. And it was a deep dive study of, at the time, the biggest per capita billionaires of past and present. And I must admit, it was a little bit above my station back then because I was just kind of getting out of debt. But I loved the book. And to be able to sit here today and say, I met the author and we had a good deep dive discussion on his work around studying billionaires, I feel very grateful to be able to do that for you. And also, I feel like it's a sign of progression of how far I've also come. So I'm very excited to say that this is an interview with Martin Fridson, who is a prolific author. Much of his work is in technical analysis. He's certainly known in, say, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal as one of the most thoughtful, perceptive and technical analysts in the markets. This particular episode is a journey through studying the biggest billionaires in history, probably up until maybe 1990, something like that. I really enjoyed it. It's a very technical dive, which I think has many great upsides and strengths. We recently published it on my podcast, Money, but because I now have so many more listeners on the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast, I thought it'd be great to share it here. So just before you listen to this, if you haven't subscribed to my podcast, Money, if you didn't even know I had another podcast, it's called Money. So make sure you do that. But no more long intros from me. Very excited to share with you my conversation interview with Martin Fridson, who wrote the book, How to Be a Billionaire.
I read your book, start of 2007.
Oh, okay.
It was in the first 5 books of non-fiction. Not that I've ever read any fiction. I haven't read anything. So Think and Grow Rich, Rich Dad Poor Dad, your book. In the first 5.
Oh.
Loved the book.
Oh, thank you.
I wasn't ready for it because I was skinny. Yeah.
So I didn't really know exactly where it would go. And I, starting out, I thought there would be more sort of financial, even hanky-panky. and there was a little bit of that in the book. But I really developed a tremendous respect for all of the men in the book. They all had, I think, worked very hard, had, you know, and the qualities I talked about, there was really, a lot to admire about them. So, having been in the financial world, I think I sort of assumed that was a bigger part of it, but, they by and large, created enterprises and, managed to hold on to the equity of them and, really built something. So it was interesting that I didn't even have the title when I started. And
really?
Yeah, I had a working title. And then at one point, the.
Can you remember what that was?
It was Cash of the Titans.
I like that.
But sort of as I was you know, well into it, the woman who was, you know, handling it for the publisher, sort of the coordinator for it, called me. She said, well, you know, we're not sure about the title. Why don't you give it some? So I came up with a list of other possible titles, and How to Be a Billionaire was almost a throwaway to me because I thought it was a little fanciful. But as soon as I said, she said, that's the one. And, you know, I realized that it really was a great title because you don't have to explain what the book's about. You know, and people, you know, get it right away, you know. And so
there's a lot to be said for calling something what it is. A lot of good books, the book is just... Like Arnold Schwarzenegger's autobiography was Total Recall, which is the name of one of his films. Just very clear, concise. Yeah, Tim Ferriss just launched Tools of Titans, didn't he? That is what his book is. Yeah, sometimes we can get a bit clever for our own good, can't we, with titles of books?
Yeah. Well, one of my others, the same publisher said, you know, we're going to call it financial statement analysis. I said, well, that's pretty straightforward. I said, you know, it seemed unexciting to me because my idea was behind the balance sheet, you know. So, but they said, no, we want to make it marketable to the college audience. And so if you have a gimmicky kind of title, that really won't work there. But I think they were right again on that because, you know, the book's now, I'm working on a fifth edition of it. So, you know, it's clearly been successful and in the professional market, which I really had thought of more than the college market, but both, it's been a good seller in both. And, so I found that publishers really are worthwhile. I think authors sort of have ideas about things, but they really need the guidance of a publisher to help them sort of refine the idea and make it something that's commercial as well as something, you know, I mean, I've always had fun writing the books, but you want to reach a large audience, you know, even aside from making the money off it, you'd like to see that impact of the book. And this book, unquestionably, I was at a conference speaking on a totally different subject, but this man came up and he says, this is my son who was maybe about 12 and so on. And, you know, he's read your book and this is his goal. And I said, you know, I'm very sure that, you know, someone, more than one person who reads the book will become a billionaire. You know, not entirely because of the roadmap in the book. You know, they have to have a lot, you know, the qualities of determination and, you know, to do it. But I think that there are some ideas. One of the endorsers of the book was someone I knew, Spencer Hayes, who had, I guess most of his money had been made in the textile and apparel business, but I knew him from, he was the president of a company I worked for, selling door-to-door in the summertime during college. And he wound up donating his $300 million art collection to the Musée d'Orsay in Paris and got some publicity. Otherwise, I don't think he was all that well known, and he wasn't someone who was seeking publicity or anything. But he was kind enough to say that, you know, gee, I wish I had had this book when I was starting out. And I took that as really the highest compliment I think I got, maybe on any book that I've written, to say, well, yeah, here's someone who had been very successful and said that, yeah, this would have been helpful to me. That was one of the things that stood out in the early billionaires. They didn't do it overnight.
I mean, of course.
It took them a long time. And I think that if some of the ideas in the book helped to accelerate that for the rising billionaires, that's terrific.
Yeah, great. Should we sit down?
Yeah, sure.
Great. Thanks for getting the water, Harry.
Is it better on one side or the other? Or
do you want, I guess because we've got the iPad there.
Okay, good.
Cheers, Marty. Yep. Thanks a lot. This is the longest Uber drive I've ever been in. Hour and 10 minutes. Nearly 100 quid in an Uber. That's not how to be a billionaire.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm sorry to...
No worries. I don't mind. I like these travels. I did a couple of calls in the car. I was on my laptop. I like coming to wherever you are to do these interviews.
Well, it's just our daughter lives here and we feel like we're sort of on call. She has a newborn, actually. So I just didn't want to stray too far and, you know, not be available. Yeah. So.
No, that's great. Marty, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Terrific to be here.
Can I just set the scene? I was really pleased when you responded when I reached out, because in the first five non-fiction, what you might deem personal development or life-changing books that I read, I think maybe the third or fourth was your How to Be a Billionaire. I remember it was a big, beefy book. And that was scary to me, having just got through Rich Dad, Poor Dad and then moved on to Think and Grow Rich, you know, working up to your book. Yeah. It had a gold cover.
Yeah.
Even your name, I mean, it was Martin, not Marty, on your book, Martin Fridson. That sounded so regal. And I just remember getting so much out of the book. And I was in debt at the time. So, it was sort of like, wow, look how big this world is. So to sit here and talk to you is a privilege for me as well. So thank you for that. So I'm fascinated by billionaires. I love watching all the autobiographical documentaries. There's been a few films that have come out on Warren Buffett and Getty, where he was painted quite badly. But most people don't really know what billionaires are like, or the commonalities. And so society, we often judge them, don't we, as maybe being a bit greedy or power hungry. But you're obviously in a position better than most, because you've done a huge amount of research and you've written a book on the subject. So the question I've always wanted to ask my whole life to someone is this: what does a billionaire know that a millionaire doesn't yet know?
Well, I think that knowing that it's possible, I think they have a belief in themselves that they can achieve this. It's typical, at least some of the billionaires who said, oh, I never really set out to make a lot of money. I just enjoyed what I was doing. And there may be such a case, but I think they were driven by the money, at least as a goal, if not necessarily for the enjoyment of the wealth itself, but as an achievement to get to that kind of a level. And I think that most of us don't realize it is actually possible to achieve such a thing. It seems so extraordinary, so far beyond the imagination, that really understanding that it is possible to achieve that, I think, is the most significant difference. Most people don't set out to do that, and I don't think everyone should. It's not the most balanced life, you might say, there, although some of the billionaires have achieved in other fields and have certainly enjoyed leisure activities. But you have to be pretty focused, extremely focused, to achieve anything like $1 billion of net worth.
So when you say not always balanced, do you mean there's attrition in other areas of their life, or just because they've been so single-minded, they've not really done anything else?
Well, again, there's some variation in that, but to give you an example, Sam Walton's family said that when they went on a family vacation, he would spend most of his time at other stores. This was the founder of the Walmart
chain. Yeah,
and he would go into other stores and copy what they were doing. He was very proud of that. He had not originated any idea. Mm-hmm. He just copied from others and did this obsessively, and genuinely enjoyed it. I don't think there's any question that the billionaires liked what they were doing, something that might seem onerous or a chore to many of us. And many of us would say, well, I'm making a good living. I'm happy when the workday is over. I can go home and spend the time with my family and or enjoy other pursuits. And again, it's not that they were completely one-dimensional, but no question that what came first was the focus on business, building an enterprise, figuring out how to capitalize on that, expand their wealth more, even after they got to a point where they were quite comfortable. Mm-hmm. Kirk Kerkorian, who made fortunes in the entertainment business and a variety of ventures, got to the point where he had sold a business and was worth $100 million at a time when it would be, it'd be equivalent to $1 billion nowadays. Said, well, what am I going to do now? Just sit around? So he wanted to make more, and he bet the whole thing. He came very close to going bust completely several more times during his career, but that was what drove him, what kept him motivated. So certainly he got to the point where he had more money than he could possibly spend. Now, some of the billionaires then turned to philanthropy as a way to make use of that wealth that they've created. That's quite a common characteristic as well.
So that one, I think, is interesting to explore. And I've got like about six questions buzzing around my head at the moment. But let's go straight in with that philanthropy one. Because I think I certainly see a lot where people haven't been surrounded by wealth, or maybe they've had an upbringing that doesn't really appreciate money for the positives, mm-hmm. assume that many billionaires or very wealthy people take from the poor, or, you know, like because they've made money, it's at the cost of other people. Every billionaire I've ever studied, I've probably interviewed four, maybe five on my podcast, is a big philanthropist. Now, according to my research, some of them didn't intend to be. Society almost forced them to be by saying, hey, wait a minute, Bill Gates, stop testing your software on us and start doing something good with your money. But of course, look how that's changed him for the great of mankind. Of course, many of these big philanthropists now are progressing humanity, you know, like Richard Branson and Elon Musk taking us to other planets. What's your research say on whether they've been greedy or overly capitalist, capitalizing on the poor versus actually being pretty generous and philanthropic?
Well, it's a very interesting question. Now, philanthropy is not uncontroversial in itself. There are those who say, oh, well, they're looking to salve their conscience after having done all these awful things to make these fortunes. And shouldn't the government really be taking care of people? Shouldn't the billionaires be taxed at very high levels so that there wouldn't be a need? And doesn't that make people beholden to these private individuals rather than benefiting from the community at large? And those are not inconsequential questions. They're fair to discuss. But I think Bill Gates, who you mentioned, is a good example. And however he came to it, he did face some criticism early in his career that he did not seem to be philanthropically inclined, but certainly is said that he's going to give away really almost all his fortune to the Gates Foundation. And they've set some very big goals. And I think it's very similar to what he sought to do in business, which was really to, as he said, get a personal computer on everyone's desk. And that really has more or less come about, at least in the wealthier countries where people are able to afford it, and increasingly even beyond that, as personal computers have become very affordable. So now he looks at the world and says, there are diseases that we can eradicate completely. It will take a lot of money to do it, and very good organization, good planning. But he's approached it in the same way, and he's pretty much devoted his life to that since sort of backing away from an active role within Microsoft. And so I think that the billionaires, when they get involved in philanthropy, that's very typical that they take on large goals like that, you know, not to say, well, let's give a few dollars here, a few dollars there. I think John D. Rockefeller was one who was also criticized being a monopolist in the oil business and so on, and certainly had some rough edges about his dealings in the business. But once he turned to philanthropy, undertook some very major projects. It was also involved in eradicating hookworm, which is a very serious disease in the United States at the time. Founded the University of Chicago, the Rockefeller University, a number of very major institutions. So they, I think, not only for the self-aggrandizement, but to say, well, I really want to make an important contribution. And so I think that it's part of that same drive that got them to the billionaire status to begin with.
Sure. So I'm quite pro-wealth and pro-capitalism. It certainly served me well. And when I was a bit more artistic, creative, anti-capitalist, rage against the machine, even somewhat hippie, forgive the stereotypes, I had a different view. But like, I've seen the great gifts that wealth give. Do you think then that a commonality of the wealthiest people on the planet is not just an ability to think big, bigger than the rest of people, but almost a delusion of how big their thinking is? Because everyone you've spoken to so far sounds like at their time when they were making these goals, they would have been ridiculed. Like they'd have been burned at the stake 200 or 300 years ago. And if you look, I interviewed someone who's got the only license to mine on the moon. And so he's a billionaire and he's basically, he thinks he will be the first person to mine the moon and remove all the radiation so it can be habitable. And that's kind of a bit crazy. So is there this line of huge vision and craziness, delusion?
Yeah, Ted Turner, one of the billionaires in the cable television business is where he made his fortune. And he has made no secret of the fact that he is manic and has to take medication to control this. And so I think that probably he has at times gotten carried away, but it has worked for him. Mm-hmm. And I think there are other examples like that. And now you could also point to people who were just crazy and had totally unrealistic dreams. So I think it requires practical ability to say, yes, this is big, this is almost beyond the scope of imagining, but I really believe it is achievable. Here's how I can get there. And you have to have a real sense of organization to be able to get there and work through other people. It's not something you can do as a one person show. Yes, it is unquestionably some of the ideas that have been out there, well, they've just never been done before. Mm-hmm. It requires that. It's also sometimes seeing the opportunity in something that's quite small. I mean, John Kluge, who made a fortune in the broadcasting business, started out with a little independent station in Washington, D.C., didn't have to pay much for it because no one really saw the potential in it except him. But he recycled old content, films and television programs that had long gone out of production but were in syndication, and actually made that competitive with the network stations in that locality and then built from there. So a lot of times it's seeing the value in an idea. I mean, discount retailing had been around. As I mentioned, Sam Walton was proud of the fact that he didn't invent anything, but he saw a much bigger potential, the potential to become the largest retailer in America. Who would have thought that from the tiny little base that he started with? But he wasn't crazy. He really had the goal. He had learned from his early experience in the retailing business how to set specific goals to achieve, and he continued to achieve them. Now, it helped that they were early in adapting modern data processing at a time when that wasn't widespread in the retailing industry. So that made a difference. But he also had some ideas about the sourcing of the products that he sold, was able to acquire them at inexpensive prices, and some specific ways for achieving that. So there were some particular ideas that enabled him to build that gigantic empire. Mm. But being able to envision it was certainly the beginning point.
Sure. So three things maybe have just come in my head from that. One is scale, one is timing, and then another is maybe the ability to take rejection. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about scale first. So the billionaire you talked about, cable, obviously cable was a local, TV was all local, and then cable nationalized it. And so the change of local to national creates the scale. And if you think about Walmart being, one store, and then it's not really so much globalized, but it's certainly nationalized in a huge mm-hmm. country. I can't think of any billionaire who has become so at a small scale. So do you want to talk about scale? Is it something, do you really have to be national, global, or even intergalactic to be able to get to that sort of wealth?
Well,
or at least embrace the challenges that scale brings.
Yeah, there are some examples of wealth very concentrated in real estate in a particular area, but those I think would be very much the exception. The the big fortunes that I think are recognizable. I mean, Richard Branson here in the UK, Michael Bloomberg, who's system, financial services, software system is certainly a global product. And that is an example. There are a lot of terminals. People have the Bloomberg terminal all over the world. Mm. Many, many. That also started as small from a little storefront in New York City. But he was able to see that this is something that would be valuable to everyone in the financial field. Some wouldn't be able to afford it, perhaps, but anyone who could, it would really become necessary. And as it became more widespread, it did become essential. You really couldn't operate in certainly the bond business, where I spent a lot of my career. It just wasn't feasible to compete without having the Bloomberg terminal. So, I think that taking it to a national and international scale is really essential to create the kind of fortunes. People do very well with businesses. They may own a few franchise restaurants in a particular area, do quite well. But to really get into the billionaire class, it requires quite a bit of scale. Mm.
Well, the Rousing family, they were into packaging. Was it Tetra Pak they owned? It was certainly a huge company. Mm. I mean, think about how many milk bottles, milk cartons, and all those kind of things. They must have sold billions and billions of them. I think sometimes we perceive that a billionaire has to do something amazing or genius or groundbreaking, but sometimes it's a very simple problem scaled to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And to the next thing. And that's timing I picked out. So you talked a bit about timing. Maybe, you know, you can't make cable go from local to national until you've got the technology to do that. You can't become a computer wizard if you haven't got a supercomputer at the university down the road from where you live. So do you think there's some luck involved, or do you think that they spot the timing of when something's going to go big? If you think of e-commerce, Jeff Bezos, but also in China, there's a lot of, well, I say a lot, there are billionaires under 30 in e-commerce on online retail, which of course, that's only a 20-year-old industry. So they got in quite early in something that was able to scale. Is it luck? Is it opportunity? Is it getting in a market at the right time?
There's no question that in this phase of rapid growth, is really the best time to get in to try to become a billionaire. Another trend was consolidation. So Wayne Huizenga, who built fortune first in the waste collection business and then went into what became for a while a very big business of rentals of films in the Blockbuster chain, then went into the auto dealership business, and starting in the waste management, that had been a very localized industry. His family had been in that business on a very local scale, but he saw that the time was coming when you could build up a large enterprise nationwide of these localized units, and of course you could utilize the truck to collect the waste more efficiently if it was serving several different local communities rather than just the one where it had been concentrated. So there was a whole technique in acquiring the businesses, working with these entrepreneurs who became part of this chain. So that was a trend that came along at that particular time. Another aspect of timing is buying when things are out of favor, and J. Paul Getty was really famous for that. I think he somewhat exaggerated his own skill in that, but there's no question he bought the Pierre Hotel right at the beginning of the Great Depression, after it had been built during the great economic boom in the 1920s, and the timing was awful for the originators of that hotel. He bought it for a quarter of what it had been paid to build, and had to wait a while because during the Depression, of course, it wasn't a time when great fortunes were being made, but he was able to attract a prominent socialite in New York that made it a popular place to hang out, that helped build the franchise, and eventually made quite a bit of money from that. He was also able to buy into some of the oil properties at times when oil prices were depressed. And that's been the history from the beginning of the oil industry back in the late 19th century, that crude oil goes through wild price swings. And invariably has come back. Maybe there will be a time when fossil fuels will become obsolete and oil prices won't come back, but so far it has worked every time. You have to have the financial staying power in order to ride it out and take advantage of it. So timing and being able to spot a trend that's coming along is very important, absolutely.
Great, thank you. So then on to the rejection. So obviously a big company of modern times that's brought in a lot of wealth is a company like Uber. And they had to go through a lot of fighting with local authorities, and they were quite disliked in a lot of areas. If you think about all the black cabs, this is bigger here in London, hate Uber. To be fair, quite a lot of billionaires are quite disliked, I think, and mm-hmm. certainly by, and misunderstood because they're disliked by people who don't know them. So do you think there's some steeliness of character required? Do you think there's any sort of personality traits that seem to be common in billionaires?
Yeah, you absolutely have to have a thick skin to succeed in this. And again, Sam Walton would be a good example because people were not happy with the small retailers being forced out, the mom and pop stores. In a lot of cases, the downtown shopping areas, you know, the high street was sort of cleared out because people would want to go to the malls and the Walmart stores out in the somewhat outlying regions. And so that was quite controversial. John D. Rockefeller, again, there were also smaller operators. He made an overt, very deliberate attempt to monopolize the oil refining business. And of course, that enabled him to squeeze the producers. So that certainly didn't make him popular. There is a response to wealth, a presumption in a lot of cases that, well, it must have been done dishonestly. Don't we need some regulation here? Because the mere fact that people are making a lot of money or these what some would consider obscene amounts of money from it is in itself proof in a lot of people's minds that there's something.
That's the role of capitalism, isn't it, to make those controls?
Yeah. You have to expect to encounter some of that response and persevere nonetheless. I think the there are billionaires who have gone through that. Well, you know, several great fortunes have been made in the private equity business, which consists of things such as acquiring family-owned businesses that have been run in a sort of paternalistic sort of way for a number of years. And a lot of the profit to be made out of acquiring that and buying it from the original owners is to run it in a stricter business-like way. That may mean longtime employees who are not all that productive but have been kept on because it was a family. They felt sort of obligated to the local community. Well, that's sort of out the window. That certainly generates some criticism from the local people, the community. There's also a sense that, this is creating a conglomerate that has its fingers in everything. These private equity companies control all these different businesses. So you may find yourself in Parliament or in Congress being vilified as sort of the wrong face of capitalism, if you will. So you certainly have to have the courage of your convictions to do that and to believe that, yes, ultimately the market system finding more efficient ways to do things, which will put less efficient competitors out of business, potentially. But you don't succeed as an economy by propping up businesses that have become obsolete. You know, that's the nature of capitalism. Attempting to do that can be a very big drag on the economy and ultimately reduces prosperity to do that. So there are unquestionably dislocations when innovation comes along and when there's disruption, ultimately it winds up better. I think it's important not to be cavalier about this, to understand the effects of that dislocation, to work towards solutions for those who wind up on the wrong end of that. It doesn't mean that those people all have to be thrown on the garbage heap. It's not productive and not efficient in the and not to the benefit of the population as a whole, ultimately, to artificially try to prop up those businesses that have become inefficient and have sort of had their day, and now it's time to move on. And that a lot of that's really driven by technology. When the technology improves, it is going to make obsolete a lot of the existing productive capacity.
Yeah, great. So I'd really like to spend a bit of time trying to get a relatively balanced view. I'm sitting here realizing I'm very pro wealth, money, capitalism, and I want to challenge my own thoughts. And of course, there are plenty of people who are very anti it. And I'd like this in many ways to be at certain points balanced. So this would be one of those. So could you talk through maybe some of the darker things you found researching billionaires? So maybe where you thought, well, yeah, you know what, maybe they were a bit greedy, or maybe that was a monopoly, or maybe they did in this instance break the rules a bit. And you can be specific or generic, it's up to you. And then let's do that first, and then afterwards we'll do all the great things, whether it's philanthropy or employment or innovation.
Sure.
So let's start with the dark stuff first.
Yeah, well, I guess the example that sticks out most of my mind is an older one, H.L. Hunt, who at the time when I was young, there were really only, I think, four billionaires, H.L. Hunt, Howard Hughes, J. Paul Getty, and Charles MacArthur from the insurance industry, who wasn't anywhere near as well known. Henry Ford had been a billionaire, but had died a number of years earlier. And Hunt was quite a colorful character in many ways, what really got him started on his path to wealth was that there was a discovery by a wildcatter. These are men who had gone out with just financed on a shoestring, drilling holes and finding oil occasionally, raising some more money, drilling another one, and in new areas, not proven fields, but really trying to make brand new discoveries, and quite a chancy sort of business. Well, this fellow had been at it for many years, was already kind of advanced in age, struck it big, and Hunt got wind of it, realized it was even bigger than this fellow realized, and got him into a hotel room with a bottle of whiskey, and wound up with the rights to this field, which was, I don't think that would quite meet my ethical standard. And writing the book, I said, well, you're going to have to make the judgments for yourself. I'm not going to dictate what's right or wrong about this, but I'll show you what these others did. So that was an example, I think, of exploitation. The surprising thing, though, in writing the book, when I started out, I thought there would actually be more of that. That would be a bigger part of it. And I was prepared to say, well, yeah, there's some financial skullduggery here that has gone into it. But, and that was partly, I think, because I had come from the financial industry myself and had seen a lot of, you know, hanky-panky in financial reporting. I had written a book about that specifically and expected to find more. But I found that by and large, the fortunes had been made through genuine contributions, genuine enterprises that really added something that improved upon what had been there before. So I really can't cite all that many examples. I'm sure most of billionaires have probably been sued at one time or another because the other parties feel that they got the shorter end of the stick. Certainly Donald Trump has been sued many times. It didn't wind up predominating in the narratives that I was able to develop.
Yeah, that's interesting. And then the upsides. So whether that might be exploring a bit more what philanthropy did, or contributions to society, or medicine and health. So what were the upsides you found and from studying billionaires?
Yes, well, I think that the both the businesses themselves that were founded and the the philanthropies they got involved with afterward have made important contributions. I think that if we go back again to Henry Ford as in his time as a lone billionaire. Now, we have to keep in mind that inflation makes a big difference. So a billion is not what it was at one time. Yeah. So many who weren't at $1 billion in their terms would certainly be billionaires today. Ray Kroc, McDonald's, I think, as an example. When I was growing up, it was believed that the restaurant business was not really something you could expand into a nationwide enterprise. You might be able to own two or three restaurants and shuttle back and forth between them to oversee them. But most of the cost was in the labor, and there really wasn't an economy of scale. And I was doing it in a bigger scale. It wouldn't save you money because they were all the costs were all localized. But he managed to do that. And I can say that if you... in contrast to when I was very young, you went to a town that you didn't know, any place you didn't know where would be a good place to eat. The rule of thumb was to look where you found police officers eating, because it was presumed that they were eating lunch every day out at a restaurant, and they would know the good places. But you really didn't know for sure. But you could be pretty confident that if you went into McDonald's, you would get a clean and well-managed operation, and certainly at an inexpensive price. I think that's an example of a real revolution in that industry. And by the way, people would criticize in some cases the nutritional value of McDonald's. I can tell you that they have introduced healthier kind of foods, which have not been that well accepted. Yeah. I think they've gone with what the public has demanded. I'm very conscious of what I eat, and I would encourage people to eat healthily. But in any business, they have responded to the consumer demand. I think the whole revolution in technology, starting with the personal computer coming along, the one real roadblock when the personal computers were developed was the absence of software to make them run. And they were at first very difficult for anyone but a real devotee, the people who are the real computer nerds today, but were the hobbyists at the time. There wasn't a lot of practical value from personal computers initially, but there was a very hardcore of people who could understand it well enough to use it. But for the average person, it was not really feasible until the software, the user-friendly software came along from Microsoft, Apple developed products and others who came along. And that has made a huge difference. I mean, it's hard, I think, for people who were not around before personal computers to understand what life was really like. Yeah. I mean, the ability... Now with Google, example, to search. I remember when search engines were being developed, there were competitors. Google ultimately triumphed because it was something you really didn't need a lot of skill to use. You put in a word and it searched, and Well, everything was there. And I can't tell you, in doing research for books, how valuable it is. I mean, ultimately, you want to get to articles, you know, get to primary sources. But with the search engines, you can get started, find a few of those articles, and then pull them down, you know, download them very easily. So life is completely different than it was before the advent of those things. And while the U.S. government did provide some of the funding for what became the internet, and that contribution shouldn't be ignored, I don't think that the government by itself would have ultimately developed the internet, and certainly not to the state that it's become. I mean, it was wonderful to hear, oh, now we have an internet. Initially, you couldn't do a lot with it. It was exciting that such a thing existed, but it really took entrepreneurs to say, oh, well, here's an application, here's a site that we could create that would really have a value. And that's not really the role of government or the nonprofit sector so much as entrepreneurs to say, well, I'm going to make a lot of money off this too if it really catches on. But I've thought about what would people really like to be able to achieve, you know, once you have that technology available of the World Wide Web.
And you have to have the incentive of profit to take the risk and do all the work and go through the regulation and obstruction and competition, and that's the reward.
Yeah. And so a lot of good. And then again, with the philanthropy, yes, a lot of great things have come about that. John Paulson, I'm very pleased to know, who's made a great fortune, $1 billion plus fortune in the hedge fund business, has dedicated very generously to education. And that's certainly an important resource for the economy, but important to individuals as well. And I think that many of the billionaires have been attracted to that idea of making that opportunity available to others. They vary. I pointed out in my book that not all of them have been rags to riches story. Some of them came from at least middle class, or in many cases, well-to-do families, but built much greater fortunes on top of whatever their parents had been able to achieve. But I think that in many cases, they really feel that it's important for everyone to have the opportunity they had, because I think they appreciate what capitalism has made possible for them. But they know that without the education that they received, they would not have been able to exploit those opportunities. And I think they feel a great sense of injustice that we haven't reached the stage where everyone has the educational opportunity, everyone who has the mind and the discipline and the ambition to achieve that doesn't have the same opportunity that they had. And so providing scholarships to students to be able to attend top universities that they can aspire to. They have the talent, but not necessarily the means to achieve, is a cause that that many identify with. I know this myself. I've been fortunate to be able to endow a couple of scholarships at the university I attended, and in talking with many classmates, as they're thinking about contributing to the universities, that's the cause, particularly the scholarships, of being able to enable others to achieve and capitalize on their native abilities, is something that really resonates, and I think with many of the billionaires as well.
So picking out a couple of things you said, like tracking things like Walmart, Google, and if you add Amazon into the mix, I think a lot of people don't understand these people who end up becoming billionaires take huge risks, their own personal fortune risks, not public sector, but private sector personal fortune risks, and ultimately create things. And I'm trying to think of any that don't, certainly in oil, internet, e-commerce. They make things that are easier, faster, better, and more convenient for us. And of course, there's always going to be a cost, which is less convenient, maybe mom and pop shops, than more convenient Walmarts, i.e. price, or everything under one roof. Amazon, it does make me chuckle that people who complain about how little Amazon pay in tax and they do all their shopping on Amazon. Yeah. But I mean, how much easier has Amazon made our life? So there's, is there this convenience factor?
I would go even beyond convenience. Please. I mean, I have a friend who happens to be very much to the left politically. I'm very fond of. But she has said that in her little town in New England, Walmart is the one store where she feels people of low incomes are treated with respect and considered important. They value them coming to their stores, and certainly made many things that would not be affordable within the reach of people of low incomes. And by the way, has had a very measurable impact on the overall gross domestic product of the United States by bringing in, and a lot of it's imported from China, another issue that has become quite controversial, but personally believe that it's very important to take advantage of global trade. I know there currently there's a big backlash against that, a move toward protectionism in the United States, but
and Brexit in the UK
and in the UK, yes. To me, I have yet to find an economist outside of the administration in the United States who doesn't believe that global international trade is a benefit. Across the board.
And pretty much everyone in England who runs a business or has a private sector entrepreneurial business focus thinks we should not exit.
And so Walmart, by doing that, bringing in inexpensive goods, has had a really positive impact on the U.S. GDP. And really, any enterprise that has improved productivity has done that.
Thanks to scale. Scale increases productivity, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I grew up in Detroit, so I was very conscious and actually went to a high school named after Henry Ford. So it was very much a part of my upbringing and knowledge. And there are a lot of valid criticisms of Henry Ford outside of the business spectrum. But by introducing the assembly line, now this was had been developed in the meat packing industry, but he brought it into the auto industry, reduced the cost of an automobile by about 80% within just a few years by doing this. And that put automobiles, which had been a luxury item only for the wealthy, only those who had owned carriages before, which was not the average working person, made that affordable as late as, I think in the 1960s, Nikita Khrushchev, who was the premier of the Soviet Union, came to the United States and visited an auto plant and saw the parking lot and said, who do those cars belong to? And he said, those belong to the workers here. And he didn't believe it. That's impossible. How can the average working person afford to own his own automobile? But this was something that was made possible by Ford and other innovators in the auto industry who made that affordable. And one of the outcomes of introducing the assembly line was, unfortunately, it was somewhat monotonous work. And the turnover rate of the workforce increased as a result of that. So what Henry Ford did is that he introduced a $5 a day wage, which was twice the going rate at the time. And he was criticized. People said, this is socialism. and he actually was forced out of the original company that he created because he wanted to raise the wages of the workers. And they said, oh, this is not a charitable institution. But he's had the vision to see that if you had a happy and well-paid workforce and didn't have a lot of turnover, that would really make the enterprise more successful. A lot of good things came out of that, and eventually, because he raised the wages, that did eventually force others to compete and raise their wages as well. It didn't happen immediately. For a long time, he was well above the average manufacturing wage, but it wound up making a lot of difference. So I think there are many good that you can point out to, even before you get to philanthropy, that really came through the You know, I like to call the free enterprise system. People are not bashful at calling it capitalism nowadays, but I think that in many people's minds has an unsavory taste to it. But the idea that yes,
a somewhat free enterprise system.
we don't have completely unbridled free enterprise. And by the way, I wrote another book that discussed this and said yes, when you have a genuine market failure, that is, you should have some intervention by the government. Do it. The difference between liberals and conservatives in the United States is how many market failures are there out there, really. What I found in doing the research on that book, which is called Unwarranted Intrusions, was that many subsidies would be introduced, often by capitalists themselves, who said, well, if I can get government to support me, that's better than having to actually go out and compete. Maybe I can get them to suppress my competitors by putting in a lot of regulations that will be hard for the smaller competitors to comply with. But those subsidies would get introduced and there would be an alleged market failure to justify it. And then what I found a pattern was that when that market failure was discredited and shown to be false, they would come up with another alleged market failure to continue that subsidy. And many of these subsidies have continued for decades and decades without any justification and as great drags on the economy. So when I talk about free enterprise, I'm talking about genuine free enterprise, not a friend of mine, Gene Epstein, who was the former economics editor of Barron's financial publication in the United States, said that he was opposed to what he calls capitalism or crony capitalism. And that's, you know, that's not to be defended any more than socialistic schemes or anything else is. If you're for free enterprise, it should be, yes, genuinely going out competing and running the risk of going broke because you don't have the government to backstop you.
Again, so many questions. We've actually only done question one on my list, so this is great. So, let's move on from the traits of billionaires, because that's kind of been the theme of our discussion so far. We may open that loop again. I'd like to talk a bit more about you, your book, which really inspired me. It's also, for me, this is also like a history lesson, because you haven't yet mentioned any modern billionaires. You're very well knowledgeable on all the billionaires you've studied. So I just had a couple of ideas. I wonder if you could ever write How to Be a Young Billionaire or How to Be a Modern Billionaire.
If I were to do a new edition, which I've shied away from for a variety of reasons, but...
What are those reasons, if you don't mind me?
Well, I think that, the story... Is there the you can learn from the billionaires going back to the past, to the present? Partly it's just that I've been preoccupied with other projects and mostly interested in doing new things. My book, Financial Statement Analysis, needs to be updated. I'm working on a fifth edition of that with my co-author, Fernando Alvarez. For the most part, I've wanted to go on to new things rather than constantly revisit old territories. But there are some differences. You mentioned the phrase young billionaire. That didn't really exist in the past.
Were they all about 60, give or take?
I think that John D. Rockefeller actually retired from the oil business at around the age of 40. Wow. He did go on to make another fortune in the iron mining business, but... that was quite the exception. Most of them took a long time to get to a billion. They were well on the way, perhaps in the 30s, but it took a long time. So Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook is quite unusual compared. And that would be the difference if I were right.
Although there's a chap in China, I forget his name. Wasn't he a 25-year-old billionaire? It's becoming more common. Is that because of technology speeding everything up, or is that because of inflation?
No, inflation has played a role to get the number of a billion, but to create a fortune on that scale, even, let's say, a mere $100 million today, I say somewhat facetiously, technology... it really has developed at a pace. It's not a matter of, well, I've been in business doing the same thing, growing it for years and years, but rather I had an idea, it caught on. We now have a billion subscribers.
Fiber optics must have helped to get information globally really quickly. That must have been a big thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But having something like the internet and saying, well, I have an application, I have a website, there's a particular need, people are interested in dating, they're interested in learning about certain topics, they're interested in buying and selling merchandise online directly to other buyers and sellers. All those ideas are something that can be expanded because of the internet much more rapidly than in the past, rather than saying, well, we're going to open 10 new stores this year, next year we'll open 20 stores, and eventually we'll have 1,000 stores. No, you don't need to go through all that steps now. Those steps nowadays. So that would be the biggest difference if I were to come out with a revised edition today. Yeah.
Okay, so how long ago did you write How to Be a Billionaire?
That was in 2000.
Right, it's almost 20 years old.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Again, I think the stories that are in there are timeless and continue to be learned from. But yeah, there are some new wrinkles that
it's owns its own place in history because, I've probably studied more modern billionaires. Because I mean, some of those, like Bill Gates was modern when you wrote the book, and now he's almost, maybe.
He's a veteran.
I would love, I'm just chatting randomly now, but I would definitely love to see How to Be a Young Billionaire, or 20 years sounds like a good time to have another edition or a follow-on. Yeah. Anyway, I'm not here to sell
you. Well,
you're
whetting my appetite for it as we speak. Yeah. Bill Gates, did get started fairly young. Then, I think that was the beginning of it becoming more feasible within a relatively short time. It didn't happen overnight. Mm. It worked very hard, had some setbacks initially. But I like to say he was actually at college when I was. I didn't know him. He was spending a lot of his time playing poker and hanging out in the Science Center, which didn't happen to be my area particularly. But I always said that if he had just cut me in for a very small percentage, I would have been able to find all the bugs in his programs, because I seem to find it. If I had a nickel for every time someone has said to me, I've been doing IT for 20 years and I've never encountered this problem before, but it has only happened to Marty Fridzen. So I felt that, think how successful Bill Gates could have been if he had cut me in for a small piece and I had helped him at that early stage. But it didn't work out that way.
Yeah,
a small percentage would have gone a long way.
Yeah. Why did you write the book? What was your motivation and drive behind writing the book?
Well, I thought there was a story that really hadn't been told. There were stories about great business leaders, but many of them, although they were well known in their own right and certainly very successful, had worked, perhaps got a share of business and become quite wealthy, but they hadn't become billionaires. And there were also books about great geniuses, inventors who had made tremendous contributions. But I noticed that many of them, Thomas Edison kind of being an exception, who became pretty wealthy. Of course, he invented a number of things and not just one big one. But for the most part, those individuals had not become fabulously wealthy either. And when I started to look into it, I realized that the billionaires, for the most part, hadn't been completely original in their ideas, but again, often recognized there was an idea that was out there, but could be exploited on a much larger scale,
Steve
much
Jobs,
more successfully.
Steve Jobs famous for that today.
Absolutely. And so, so I thought that that really was a missing piece. There wasn't really a book out there like that. Mm. And I found that, yes, when I started looking into it, they had certain techniques, the individual who was taking it large risk, it was also retaining the bulk of the equity. I mean, Bill Gates didn't give away the company to venture capitalists. Steve Ballmer also owned a significant piece of it, Paul Allen. But it wasn't...
This is a huge point, I think. I spoke to someone who had a very, very famous TV show in the 90s. It's a comedian. And he only owns 6% equity in the show. All the 94% of the revenue is distributed to everybody else. I've interviewed reality TV stars, reality pop stars, and you know, people are in these manufactured bands and they get royalty checks for pence and they own like very small percent of their own IP. Yeah. So is it a common trait that they own a good amount of equity of these assets?
That's generally the case that they, now they may have had to borrow a lot in order to do that, and borrowing is an essential, you know, inherently risky. You have the debts to pay. You may not have the revenues coming in quite on a steady basis, but the interest payments are pretty much a regularly scheduled thing that you have to meet. So you run the risk of going broke, being undercapitalized. So it's not easy to retain the equities, particularly as the enterprise is growing. There may be some value, and some of them, I think, did wisely bring employees, particularly key employees, in some cases a very broad-based employees, into equity ownership. Many millionaires were created
out of Microsoft. Why do you think that was wise? Is it because it saves on paying extra, or is it because it gets the staff vested and incentivized into the company, or both?
I think both, but the second part is certainly a big part of it. You have very loyal employees. As a result of that, they have a stake in the business. The people who are going to work the hardest generally are the owners of the business. Employees are going to tend to say, well, I've done my part. It's 5 o'clock, time for me to go home. Whereas an owner of the business doesn't get to do that. Even if it's a small business, they have to be there. They may have to be there on holidays. They may have to leave some family gathering because there's an emergency that they have to deal with. And, employees are inherently not going to be as dedicated as that. On the other hand, if they have a stake, I've been very fortunate to have equity stakes in companies I've worked for. I've been and am currently an owner of a business, and it certainly gives you a different attitude about that. So, a well thought out employee stock ownership plan, or bringing in partners who can make a great contribution and giving them a significant stake in the business, having a lot of upside, really can be a very wise business policy.
Great. And let's go before your book. I'm just very grateful you wrote that book. Before that book, for those people who don't know so much about your journey, Marty, and obviously your great focus on financial analysis and all of the things that you do. So can you just let us know sort of maybe a bit of your journey of how you became to specialize in what you do specialize in?
I was in business school and had worked in summers selling books door to door. I'm very proud of the fact that I recruited a fellow who is now the president of that company, called Southwestern Company, based in Nashville, Tennessee. But out of that, I got interested in business. I had been thinking of law as a career, but concluded that business, what I liked about it was very inductive rather than deductive. You know, law, you had in the United States a constitution, you have the common law system, you're sort of deducing from that what the application of a particular case might be. Very interesting. I still find that interesting in the process, but I was more interested in this inductive process. You know, there are no solutions out there in business. You have to sort of figure it out. Everything is a new challenge, and it may be an entirely new business where no one knows what the roadmap is. So I found that very exciting. Went to business school and was looking really more at the manufacturing. We studied at my at Harvard Business School very much the case study method, and many of the cases were based on manufacturing companies. And that's sort of how I was oriented to think. But I got an invitation based on my sales experience to interview with a Wall Street firm. It was the furthest thing from my mind. A classmate of mine by the name of Bruce Morrow, I'll be forever indebted, said, well, you should go on this interview. You never know when you might find out. So I said, all right, well, the company was called Mitchell Hutchins. It's long since been absorbed by Payne Weber, which was then absorbed by UBS. But they said, well, if you have another interview in New York, we'll pay half of the cost for you to come here. So I did. I had met a girl who lived in near New York and arranged to get together to have dinner with her. She came to the city, and I didn't know any hotels, so I stayed at a place called the Park Sheraton, which turned out to be a magnificent townhouse that had been turned into a hotel. And I said, well, I don't know any restaurants in New York, but they seemed to have a restaurant at the hotel. We went in, she looked at the magnificent crystal chandeliers and said, oh my gosh, is this what happens when you work on Wall Street? So my attitude changed immediately. Yeah. I became very serious about this interview. Mm. And fortunately hit it off quite well, I think, with the interviewers. They made me an offer, and I thought to myself, well, I'll have other opportunities to do some of these other things that I have offers from, but this could be my only chance to come to work on Wall Street. And I liked the company. It was a more laid back kind of place, not quite the pinstripe, you know, gray suits that I'd expected, and very friendly place, and very intellectually exciting, because Mitchell Hutchins was known as a leader in research. And I got to know some of those analysts who were very smart, and it was exciting. We used to have a meeting on Monday morning, and people asked me, what's the most exciting time of the week for you? And I said, Monday morning. I said, oh, that's the worst time for me. I hate, you know, finishing the weekend and then having to go to work. I said, but these meetings, they would have coffee and donuts, and I'd get to listen to these very smart analysts talk about their stocks and about the economy and so on. And I loved that. And I started out trading corporate bonds, and enjoyed that very much. It was, I found, very entrepreneurial, developing a network of regional dealers that we sort of acted as a distributor toward, and learned how to value the different bonds. And then the fellow who had originally hired me, the name of Jack Rifkin, who I owe so much to. He's unfortunately passed on in the last couple of years. But after Mitchell Hutchins was acquired by Payne Weber, he went with them. Our group split off, went with another company. But Jack then contacted me and said, well, you know, I think you would do really well in research. That was quite a change. But I said, well, it would be a good idea to diversify my experience, learn a different part of the business. I had no real experience in doing that, had learned a little bit. Had I foreseen this, I would have taken some courses that I didn't take in business school about financial analysis. But I became part of a team headed by another fellow who unfortunately has also passed on, named Russ Fraser. I said, well, how do you do this? How do you figure out these companies? He said, well, here is a loose leaf notebook. I don't know if anyone even knows what a loose leaf notebook is nowadays, but he said, in here are financial ratios for the different companies at the different ratings of the rating agencies, and classified by the different industries, so you can get an idea what the averages are, what a company would be that would be better than average within its industry or within its rating category. And it was a very systematic approach, and I just started one by one. I had to follow about 130 companies, which is absurd to believe that you'd be able to be on top of those. But just before I got there, five analysts had left for a rival company, and there was a what they call the back office crisis, which was a sort of an overload of the trading volume relative to the very primitive computer capabilities that they had at the time. And Payne Weber had unfortunately merged with another company that was apparently the only company that didn't have a compatible computer system with theirs. And as they were trying to get that reconciled, this back office crisis hit, and Payne Weber was technically insolvent because it, the unmatched trades were deducted from your net capital, and Payne Weber was technically insolvent, but the regulators decided it would be bad to have them go under and create a panic. So, but the upshot of this was that they were unable to hire to any great extent. So I had to replace the five analysts who had left. And so I had a very large universe, but I followed them in a very systematic way. Every day would write up another company and get through them all in about a 6 month period and then start over again. And then started to learn more about the industry, you know, beyond following individual companies or a particular industry, but some of the broader things was, did a stint at a couple of other companies, and then became the head of the bond research group at Morgan Stanley, a very fine investment bank, and later at Merrill Lynch. And as it went on, I wound up being asked to write a chapter in a book about financial statement analysis. Of a friend of mine, Ed Altman, was the editor of that series, and the gentleman who had written the book, that chapter in the previous edition had died, so Ed asked me if I would do that. It was the biggest project by far that I had taken on, to write a whole chapter in a book. But when I got through with that, the editor of the series at Wiley, the publishing company, named Carl Weber, said, well, how would you like to turn that into a book? And I foolishly said yes, not realizing how big a job it would be. And I spent evenings writing that book, and unfortunately, our second child had been born, who was a boy, and for those of you who hadn't had that experience, boys tend to be somewhat more colicky than girls, so he spent a lot of that time screaming while I was trying to write the book, so that turned out to be a challenge, but I eventually got it done, and that book is now in its fifth edition, and once I got through with that, Carl said to me, well, what's your next book going to be about, which I hadn't thought about really, but went on and continued writing, and then eventually the idea of writing How to Be a Billionaire came to me, although it didn't start out quite with that title, and not quite the concept that I wound up following. But I found that the interesting part of it was, well, what were the techniques that these individuals used that enabled them to achieve what so few had been able to at that time?
Sure. Great. Wow. Fascinating. Can we have a 1 minute break?
Yeah.
And then we'll maybe go into some quicker fire questions. Mm-hmm. It's reminded me of all the things I read in the book, nearly 12 years ago. It's like a history lesson, because a lot of people don't so much talk about the older billionaires, obviously with all these young billionaires that there are now, and everyone knows about Jeff Bezos, and everyone talks about Steve Jobs in business, but I think one thing you learn studying billionaires is that history tends to repeat itself, cycles tend to repeat itself. People tend to capitalize on opportunities that they didn't design. They often just re-innovated from something that was existing but hadn't been scaled, or wasn't functioning to its best ability, or wasn't in the right function, or just didn't reach many people. So whether it's Sam Walton taking one small shop and making it national, or oil, which obviously became global. And now you're seeing the pattern repeat again with the internet, fiber optics, and the speed of light has just accelerated the reach that entrepreneurs have and business owners have, which means they can accumulate wealth quicker, because the faster you can get out to people, the quicker you can solve their problems. When you read a book that you really like, you hold the author in very high regard, like a deity. And so to meet him and speak to him and see that he's well-researched, well-educated, a normal, ordinary, friendly, personable chap as well. That's kind of a fun experience to go through. Yeah. All right, you ready?
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, how long does When you do the final podcast, how long does that...
We usually put it out with pretty much unedited form.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I mean, seems to be the content style that people favour nowadays.
Oh, really?
Well, because it's honest. If there's nothing cut out, then there's nothing that could have been there that's been taken out.
And no putting in the question after to make the answer.
Exactly,
sound worse than it was.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, a lot of people are edited, aren't they, and in a way that they didn't intend to answer the question, or they're set up.
Yeah,
and obviously, hopefully you feel that that's not my ulterior motive.
It's just
a subject I'm fascinated about. So sure. I'll tell you what would be good to do now, Marty, to respect your time and to get a bit of sort of a move towards the end, is to maybe do some short answers.
Okay. So let me try to maybe keep it to a minute.
We like to move the podcast towards the end by doing what we call the quick fire. Doesn't mean you have to rush the answer, but because we can summarize some of the things we've discussed. So was there a billionaire of yours that you favored? You thought, he's the guy I'd like to, inspired me of all the ones you studied?
Well, there were so many, and I really admired all of those in their own ways that I studied. I think in some ways, Ross Perot really appealed to me. Personally, he was a real innovator in the data processing, brought that to enterprises and even to government to make things more efficient. And I think also had a really good attitude toward people. One of the stories he told was during the Depression, his mother pointing to a hobo, someone, a tramp, someone who lost his job and who she did help, and saying, his circumstances are just different. He's not any different from us. And, when Ross Perot ran a company and said that, at some of the big companies, the idea would be to see a snake and say, let's have a committee to study snakes and decide what to do. And, at his company, we kill the snake. So there were a lot of things. I think he was a very genuine person that I think just at a personal level really appealed to me there. I think Sam Walton was someone that I also admired and felt had a real humanity to him that I personally identified with.
Great. So could we summarize some defining traits of billionaires? I think we talked about focus. I think we talked about scale. I think we talked about maybe an ability to deal with challenge and resistance from lots of people, timing, opportunity. So we've discussed those. Are there any others you'd add, defining traits of billionaires?
Yeah, I think the willingness to take large risks is important. These were not individuals. I mentioned Kirk Kerkorian as an outstanding example, but I think the Lawrence Tisch would be another who really put it on the line after having accumulated a lot of wealth, certainly a level that most people would be quite satisfied with and start to wonder, well, how can I spend all this money? Mm-hmm. But was willing to take a risk even at that stage. It's one thing to take risk when you have nothing to lose, but when you have a lot and say, well, I'm going to take out a loan on what I've accumulated already, thinking I can make even more. So that, I think, would be a one to put up very high on the list. Mm.
I think we didn't discuss it, but it sounded like you'd referred to it a few times. Patience. It sounded like you said, it doesn't, it's not overnight, it takes time. And obviously, whilst that's got shorter now, maybe because of technology, is that a key element, do you think, that longer term view and the patience of thinking?
Yeah, and I think that going hand in hand with that is the ability to accept setbacks because it's not only that it doesn't come overnight, but it comes after many attempts, sort of paths that don't work out. And it's easy to get discouraged. But it may be that the enterprise that ultimately becomes successful is not really the direction you were going in initially, and the opportunities that arise may come from unexpected quarters. I think that was certainly the case with Microsoft. They had a very clear direction they wanted to go in terms of making software available on a wider scale, but the system that really got them going, the QDOS system, was something that they didn't know about when they started out. They really sort of happened upon it, and so I think that being flexible and patient in saying, well, yeah, yes, we're on a path, we're determined to go that way, but if it isn't working out, being able to say, well, don't keep going down a path that's not going to work ultimately, but there's a slight veering off in another direction that has much more potential, and we have to be not stubborn. Determined is one thing, but pig-headed is not the way to go.
Sure, great.
What's the best advice you've ever received? Now, by the way, a couple of these questions here, I think, are pretty lame questions on my part. Mm-hmm. But each time I ask them, I get pretty good answers. So don't judge my questions too much. Best advice you've ever received?
Yeah, I think the best advice I ever received was to explore the direction I ultimately took going to Wall Street, which was so far, I can tell you, that was absolutely not what I was thinking at all, not the way I envisioned my life going. And often that is the best advice, to really try something that's just very far removed from what you had in mind.
Great. And then the worst advice you ever received, if you can remember it.
Well, I was actually advised not to go to Wall Street because I was specifically going to work in the bond department. And at the time, it had been a period when interest rates had gone down shortly before that. And the fellow who was telling me this didn't quite understand that that actually is a very good thing for the bond business, because interest rates coming down means that bond prices are going up. So the first year or two that I was in the business, we did phenomenally well, and it was actually a very good time. And I laugh about it now. I'm still very friendly with this fellow who had given me this advice, but fortunately I had the wit or luck not to follow that advice. Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Is there one particular thing you feel strongly that's kind of wrong with the world, or something that you want to change?
I think that what I would change if I had a magic wand is to level the playing field for opportunity. Something I remember discussing in Business Wife, and I've spoken about with my wife, you know, she likes to say that one idea is of equality is that all the outcomes are equal. The better idea of it is that the opportunities are all equal. And that's not an easy thing to achieve. I think the United States is really built on that idea. But could I say that we are achieving that ideal currently? Unfortunately, we still have more poverty than we should as a wealthy nation. The education is not at a level that it should be. We should be, as one of the wealthiest nations, certainly up at the level of Finland and South Korea, which are considered the best at the primary school level. No reason why we can't achieve that. The biggest obstacle to it is the poverty level of students. We have schools that very much perform at the level of the Finnish schools. Not all of them do, but there's no reason why they shouldn't all. But when you have 30% of the students below the poverty line, it's just very difficult to achieve that, even with very dedicated teachers. Sure. So that's the thing that I would like most to change, but I know, having studied the issue and looked at people who with very good intentions have gone off with the wrong ideas about how to reform the school system, that it's something that there's not a silver bullet. There's just a lot of things that need to be done to achieve that.
Sure. Okay, thank you. So finally then, I have two podcasts, and I've been sitting here through this thinking, which one shall I publish this episode on? And I'm going to publish it on both because I've enjoyed it so much. So one podcast is called Money, and obviously that's obvious to fit. And another one's called The Disruptive Entrepreneur, which is the slightly bigger podcast at the moment. So that word disruptive, I always like to ask everyone I interview, what does the word disruptive mean to you?
Well, it's a great question, and it's a great word. I think in most contexts, it's viewed as a negative. Things are going along in a nice, even keel, and here's someone who's disrupting things. And, you know, think of the other words that have rupt in them. There, and I've studied this. There are a very small number in the English language. Corrupt. Interrupt.
Abrupt.
Abrupt. Yeah. Bankrupt. they're generally not positive words. Mm. But it's very interesting to me that in the business context, disrupt has become a highly positive word. And what it really is about is an idea that's been around really since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, to say there's a better way to do things. We can make things cheaper. We can make them better. We can make them available to a larger portion of the population. But it's going to require changing things the way things are done. And change is not something that comes easily to most people. I can't boast of being the most receptive of change to myself. I've had to train myself really to be receptive to change. But ultimately, if you think about it intellectually, say, yes, that's the better thing. We have to be ready to adapt and to change. And so that's what it means to me, is bringing better things to better people more inexpensively, but realizing we'll have to break some things along the way to get there.
Sure.
Thank you. So I don't want to finish yet without giving everyone listening the opportunity to follow you, or is there one or two of your books that you think would be most interesting to the readers? Obviously, we've talked a lot about How to Billionaire. I can't recommend that enough. Mm-hmm. Is that available on audio?
Yes, there is an audio version of it.
Great.
That was done. And
is that on Audible? Because I couldn't find that when I looked.
Okay, well, perhaps
we're in the UK.
It's Conan Nightingale is the publisher of so that may help to track it down. Right. Conant Nightingale. Earl Nightingale, by the way, was the name behind that. Was a great motivational speaker, and they do a lot of audiobooks that are highly inspirational. If you're particularly interested in the stock market, although it's very U.S. oriented, I think that it provides some insight. A book called It Was a Very Good Year, which looked at the 10 best years in the stock market in the 20th century in the U.S. and looked for the common thread so they would be able to recognize when it's coming again. I mentioned the financial statement analysis book, which has some, I think, very valuable case studies on how companies have been able to be deceptive. Some of those are from the UK, Europe, and elsewhere. So it's not by any means only applicable in one country. So I think that that's well worth studying and has been adopted by some investment organizations or used as a training book for their analysts coming in.
Do you do any social media? Do you make any commentary online?
I do comment on Twitter, also on Forbes.com. With other responsibilities, I don't post as frequently as many others do, who really sort of make a career out of it. But those are the main ones that I've used, and I try to bring attention, particularly through Twitter and LinkedIn, to works I publish elsewhere that are available online.
And is it Martin Fridson or Marty Fridson, if we were to search?
Martin Fridson would be the best way to search for me, yes.
Great. Well, Marty, thanks a lot for spending your time. I don't want to take you up anymore because I know you've got family to see. But I've really enjoyed this.
Yes, I have as well. Thank you so much.
The camera have as well. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, really enjoyed you, and
thank you.
And thanks to both of you. I know you've been very hard. It seems to me it must be tremendously fatiguing to film for quite as long as that.
These things are good, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your shoulders were going a bit, weren't they?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah,
I need to go to the gym more.
Yeah, great. Right.
But no, this has been a lot of fun. And will you send me a link ultimately? So that, yes. And I'll, of course, I'll do my best to get the word around by
thank you.
That as well.
Appreciate that. Yeah, well, I guess it'll go in, what, a few weeks,
I think, start of February, we've got a central form.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. We'll look forward to that. Yeah, we'll send you all the links.
Fantastic.
Thanks a lot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. I have walked off.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's such a good job.
You get quite a lot of money for them on eBay.
How about that?
$1,000.
Really? Yeah. Okay, well, that's nothing to sneeze at for 15 minutes work. Yeah. I mean, that's
how pretty good. Right? Steal those
microphones. I mean, I did return it, but I was out of the building before I realized that. Okay. Rocking out for them. It's a... okay,
I don't need that.
Yeah,
so, you can have that.
I just in the habit of putting them into that pocket. So.
Thank you, John.
Okay, I'm going to run along.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.